Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 117. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at The Mummy and The Mummy Reboot. I'm not going to tell you more because there are a couple of surprises there, but they're basically it. We're going to be looking at undead Egyptians from 3,000 years ago doing nasty things while people try to stop them. So anyway, sit back. I'm going to get the contact details out of the way, and then we can start talking about linen wrappings. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from Georges Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Ça va, mes amis? Yeah, it's Terry. I'm here doing the podcast thing, and I'm still going to terms with this retirement thing, which is kind of a weird headspace for me. I went to a party yesterday. My friend Sarah had her 50th, and there were a lot of people I'd known for a very long time at the party. And people say, well, how's retirement treating you? And I'm kind of going, because I really don't know at this stage. It's a very weird headspace. I haven't got myself into a routine of doing all the creative things I want to do and kind of working out the next phase of my life. It's a first world problem of the first order, and I totally accept and recognize that. But when you're in the middle of it, it feels a lot more important than it is in the scheme of the greater world. But I'm going to be getting my shit together. I really want to plan to do that more this week. I'm going to, one of the things I've got is I've got myself a nice little writing laptop. About $300. It doesn't have very big donk in it at all. In fact, to upgrade the memory, I had to put in a 64 gig SD card, micro SD card, into the side of it so it's got enough memory. That's how light this laptop is for the tech wonks out there. What I'm going to do with that is I'm going to head off to the local library or somewhere quiet like that and write and do the research for podcasts, write up the scripts for the YouTube videos I plan to do but haven't got my ass into gear about doing. And I will be linking those in the podcast notes so that people can do that. And all those kind of creative things that I want to do. I want to write more movie reviews as well. I'm watching movies, but I'm not actually reviewing them. But I've given myself 4 weeks. We've had 2 weeks away various times doing various things and 2 weeks sitting on my ass not doing too much at all besides playing computer games and watching videos. But it's time, I think, now to kind of settle down and get the creative stuff happening. And that's very much what I want to do. Shout out to some people. I want to shout out to Dave Mack, who survived the Houston floods successfully. Good on you, Dave. We were really hoping that you would and hoping things weren't too bad for you. And I hope the infrastructure around you gets organized fairly soon. I don't think that the guy in the White House is going to particularly help you with that, but I'm sure that your local community will do so. So shout out to Dave. Want to shout out again to the Patreon supporters who are all wonderful, and to the people who leave little comments when I mention that I've done the podcast, and the people who link to it. And by the way, podcasts like Silver and Gold and the B-Movie Podcast are incredibly generous in that they let me put the links to my latest episodes up on their Facebook pages. And if anybody wants to put a link to their latest podcast up on the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook, please do. I really want to be able to help out reciprocally, and I said that correctly, so that other people get the any kind of promo boost that my small efforts may offer them. So there is that. What I also want to do is when I do the YouTube video, I may well do one on podcasting. And I may do a thing about the best, you know, 5 or 10 podcasts that I like, and they'll be movie podcasts because that's my community. That's my whanau, as the Māoris in New Zealand say. And, yeah, so I want to do more of that kind of stuff. But as we all know, I'm not a very organized person. Nonetheless, I think this is an opportunity for some adulting and for some personal growth in getting my shit together. So that's the plan. So I'm just going to bring up the Letterboxd and remind myself what I've been watching and just kind of give you guys a bit of an overview of the stuff I've been running over my retinas since the last time we spoke.
The clown with his pants falling down o'er the dance. That's a dream of romance.
Or the scene where the villain is me. That's entertainment.
Okay, well, Sally and I went up to Echuca up on the Murray River border with New South Wales and had an overnight stay there and looked around some shops and bought some stuff and just generally chilled out. Apart from hitting a galah with the car, which didn't damage the car, by the way, but the galah, was DOA. Apart from that, we bought some DVDs because apparently antique shops are now getting the dregs from video shops that have closed down. And, of course, almost all video shops have closed down. And so for $5, I picked up The Cannonball Run, starring Burt Reynolds, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Dom DeLuise, and a host of others, which is a kind of rip-off of Roger Corman's Cannonball, starring David Carradine. We all know that. But the weird thing is that the case I got this in said Cannonball Run 2. So I thought, yeah, I'll get it. It's Cannonball Run 2, and I haven't seen Cannonball in a long time, but I'll take a look at Cannonball Run 2. And then when I opened it up when I got it home, it was actually the first Cannonball movie. So I've got a case that says Cannonball Run 2. I've got Cannonball Run, the movie, with Burt Reynolds, Dom DeLuise, and a host of others. Lots of cameos and little bits of business on about a cross-country race across America. All the usual stuff there. Yeah, that's kind of funny, and it kind of works, and it's very late-era Dean Martin, maybe one of his last film roles, and Sammy Davis Jr. in there as well. The jokes are very, very cliched and silly. The car stunts are pretty good, but it was a kind of a nostalgic thing, but I've got a greater fondness for Cannonball, the one that Corman did, and I think Paul Bartel directed, starring David Carradine, than I have with this one. Even though this one's replete with celebrities, I still prefer Cannonball. And the other weird thing is, of course, Burt Reynolds' toupee. I always have a fascination with actors you know have got extremely obvious toupees. And I was watching Burt Reynolds' toupee all the way through the movie. And that can be very distracting from what the movie's actually supposed to be about. But nonetheless, I watched it. It was a bit of a nostalgia for the 1980s, and it explains why the music of the 1980s isn't very good, because way too many of the movies of the 1980s weren't very good either. One of the other films I picked up really cheaply was Pillow Talk, the Rock Hudson, Doris Day movie. It's also got Tony Randall and the person who was the reason that I watched the movie again this time, Thelma Ritter. We all know from listening to previous podcasts of mine that I love Thelma Ritter. Nominated for Oscars 6 times, never won one. Brilliant comedic actor, brilliant character actor and dramatic actor. She was in Pick Up on South Street, amongst other things, where she was brilliant. And in this one, she playing against Rock Hudson and Doris Day, who are doing that kind of cute, flirty Doris Day professional virgin. Rock Hudson pretending to be a playboy bachelor. Tony Randall pretending to be a kind of male privileged millionaire who wants to get into Doris Day's knickers. And Thelma Ritter plays Doris Day's drunken housekeeper, Alma, who is brilliant. She has this repeated thing where she gets out of the elevator and has some kind of dialogue and badinage with Alan Jenkins, the actor playing the elevator driver. And that's brilliant. And she's brilliant all the way through it. There's a terrific scene with Thelma Ritter drinking Rock Hudson under the table. And she's the only reason to see this movie. Apart from that, it's dated, it's cliched, it's sexist, it's also really icky in a lot of ways, but I would just watch a supercut of every bit of film from that movie with Thelma Ritter in it and be incredibly content, really happy with it because she was brilliant. She does a brilliant drunk act, doesn't overdo it. It's a really nuanced and clever and well thought out alcoholic kind of thing. And I know there are people out there that don't think alcoholics are funny, but the funny part for her character isn't the fact that the character's alcoholic, it's the fact that she's an opinionated woman of a certain age, and she plays well to a modern audience because of that, because she's forthright in her opinion. She doesn't take shit. She gives the best advice to Doris Day about things, which is often not taken because of the way these movies run. But, yeah, I just loved her for Thelma Ritter. I didn't love her for anything else at all. In fact, it was the first movie that I saw on my brand-new 55-inch 4K television, which I picked up very cheaply from a company called Kogan. It's a smart TV, so it's got basically runs Android. And I love having a TV set the size of a dining table. There's something nice about it. And the funny thing is that Sal usually watches her stuff in the front room, where she's got her two game consoles set up, and she's got all of her crafting stuff, so she can sit down, watch TV or watch YouTube or something and craft. So she came in and we watched Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 on the big screen. We'd seen it at the cinema, but we had an at-home movie date night to watch Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which looked fantastic on a big 4K screen, even though it wasn't a 4K version of the movie. The upscaling was brilliant and it was wonderful. And Sal apologized to me because she got crazy jealous of my new TV set. And it was very sweet and very lovely and very her that she got jealous of it. But having that enormous screen to watch things on gives me a much more cinematic experience at home, and I like that. Before that, I think I had about a 40-inch screen or something like that, and it was starting to get a bit buggy. The sound would drop out occasionally, that kind of stuff. So I had to upgrade anyway, and I'm glad I upgraded to an enormous fat-ass TV set. But moving right along, next thing I watched was a Mario Bava movie, and the worst Mario Bava movie, by the way. Remember last podcast I talked about Cal Tiki, the Immortal Monster, which is a very good early Mario Bava movie. About six or seven years later, he did his worst movie, which was Dr. Girlfoot and the Gold Bombs, the sequel to Dr. Girlfoot and the Bikini Machine, both starring Vincent Price. This one also stars Fabian and a very, very bad Italian comedy duo called Franco and Ciccio, who are about as funny as a positive biopsy. They really are kind of woeful physical comics. I mean, I don't know how well they played to Italian people. I suppose they had a certain level of fame and fortune there, but it's not a kind of comedy that translates well. And it's one of Vincent Price's worst movies, in fact. But I watched it because I picked up a box set of the two Dr. Goldfoot movies and also the Vincent Price movie Master of the World, which I kind of bought the box set for more than anything. And so I watched that and I wasn't happy with it, to be really honest with you. Then we decided that we were going to watch, Sal's an enormous fan of this franchise, and we'll watch them all and cack ourselves laughing. And it was Sharknado 5 Global Swarming, which is a Sharknado movie, of course. It's got the usual people in it. It has Dolph Lundgren in it as well, which is kind of interesting. And it has tons and tons of kind of past their use-by-date celebrities. It's got weird things like Olivia Newton-John running a Death Ray battle station out of the Sydney Opera House. It's got some crazy stuff. It's got Chris Kattan playing the British Prime Minister. There's all sorts of... It's got to be seen to believe. If you haven't seen a Sharknado movie, my suggestion is this. Get really drunk, like totally drunk, or use some medicinal marijuana legally, and then sit down and watch some Sharknado movies, because they're going to be improved by that. Once you've kind of embraced the insanity and absurdity and bad special effects and off the wall bug fuck craziness of these movies, they're a lot of fun to watch. They're not Solaris, they're not Tarkovsky's Solaris, but they are really fucked up science fiction movies, and we kind of like watching them. So when a new one comes out, Sal and I are definitely there watching it and kind of grooving and understanding what the what we're watching and why we're watching it. And yeah, it's a vulgar pleasure. Let's just call it that. The only other thing I'm going to talk about that I watched. Well, I'm going to talk about the two movies for the podcast, of course. But the other thing was, I was scrolling through YouTube, and there are some YouTube channels containing old science fiction and horror movies from the 40s and 50s. And I saw one called Voodoo Island, starring Boris Karloff. It also has Elisha Cook Jr. in it, and Rhodes Reason, the not quite as successful brother of Rex Reason, who was in This Island Earth. And it's about a bunch of people who go to an island that a developer wants to turn into a tropical resort, and find out that it's got, you know, a tribe of voodoo natives there, and tons of carnivorous plants that end up eating lots of people. Some of them are water-based plants, some of them are land-based plants, some of them resemble triffids. Incredibly low-budget film. It's basically somebody walking around a rainforest filming a movie with Boris Karloff in it. Karloff gets to do some very plummy dialogue in it, which is always nice with that kind of posh British lisp of his. And it actually worked well. It was only like 70-odd minutes, so it wasn't going to be sucking up a lot of your lifespan. But it was a lot of fun to watch. You should check it out on YouTube if you get the opportunity. I saw it on the really big TV again. And just, again, I kind of embraced what it was for what it was. And I was entertained. There's one of the female characters, there's a hint of lesbianism about her, which is kind of interesting in that kind of movie, and a bit unexpected. And there's the usual ingenue and the hero and character actors of various types, Elisha Cook Jr. being one of them. Each one's got a little bit of character arc, which is kind of nice. Sometimes they just have a generic person there, but they don't give you any backstory for them. We get a little bit of backstory for some of the characters in this one, so it's a little bit better than it could have been. It's very much of the bottom of a drive-in movie program kind of movie. But, you know, I kind of enjoyed it. And I may dip into more of those. I've got a few of them saved on my watch list on YouTube, my favourites. So I may well dip into those because they're entertaining. They don't cost me anything to watch, which is a big virtue. And I may well pick up on something a little bit interesting, which I might use for a future podcast. So anyway, it's probably time to get on with the movies that the podcast is about. I said I was going to do The Mummy and the reboot of The Mummy, which I am, but not what you expect. I'm doing the 1932 Mummy, starring Boris Karloff, and I'm doing the reboot they did in 1940, Universal did in 1940, which started with The Mummy's Hand. So I've kind of, when I said at the start of the podcast I was doing The Mummy and The Mummy reboot, people may have thought Brendan Fraser and Tom Cruise, but I misled you deliberately. I apologise. So sit back, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back we're going to be talking about the classic 1932 movie directed by Karl Freund, The Mummy, starring Boris Karloff.
Death, eternal punishment, for anyone who opens this casket.
The Mummy, is it dead or alive? Human or inhuman? You'll know, you'll see, you'll feel the awful, creeping, crawling terror that stands your hair on end and brings a scream to your lips. Ah! There's nothing on earth like The Mummy.
You will not remember what I show you now, and yet I shall awaken memories of love and crime and death.
Now I know his horrible plan. He's going to kill her and make her a living mummy like himself.
Ah!
The Mummy is a 1932 pre-code Universal horror film starring Boris Karloff as Imhotep slash Ardeth Bey, Zita Johann as Helen Grosvenor, and Ankinis Amon, who is an Egyptian queen. David Manners as Frank Wemple, Arthur Byron as Sir Joseph Wemple, Edward Van Sloan as Dr. Muller, and Bramwell Fletcher as Ralph Norton. The previous year, Karloff had struck it big in his mid-40s, playing Frankenstein's monster in James Whale's Frankenstein. He wasn't credited as that. The monster was just a question mark in the credits of Frankenstein. But he became very famous very fast on the basis of that. People were looking around for a replacement of Lon Chaney, and Karloff fit the bill for a while. He was an interesting character. He started out in England, not very successfully in business, and went to Canada and did things like farm labouring in Canada until in his 20s he found acting and took on the stage name of Boris Karloff. His real name was William Henry Pratt. He did a lot of stage work, and by 1918 he was working on stage until the 1918 flu outbreak in the San Francisco area stopped his stage work, and he did a little more repertory stuff. And in 1918 or so he got his first role in a Frank Borzage film at Universal Studios, for which he got $5. People have been trying to find out which film it was, but they can't really find it, and he really doesn't remember the name of the film. So he made dozens of silent films. He didn't work very often. He had to do ditch digging and delivering construction plaster for a living, amongst other things. There are some surviving films from this time: The Masked Rider, The Hope Diamond Mystery from 1920, King of the Wild. In 1931, he was in a movie called The Criminal Code, a prison drama, which he'd done on stage, and got a bit of recognition for that. And then James Whale found him for Frankenstein. Jack Pierce did that iconic makeup for it, and his career skyrocketed. He was, at the time, about 44. In the year between Frankenstein and The Mummy, he made 10 movies, one of which was The Mask of Fu Manchu. But he made 10 movies in that one year, and then he didn't have to kind of take the smaller roles. After that, though, he was prolific. He made a hell of a lot of films over the arc of his fame, which lasted from, say, 1931 until his death in the 1970s. And I'll get the exact year here. No, sorry, 1969. I apologise. He died in 1969 at the age of 81. Karloff was perfect for these kind of roles. He had a very strong and unusual bone structure, a slightly swarthy appearance. One of his ancestors may have been Anglo-Indian. And his great-aunt was actually Anna Leon Owens, the woman on whom The King and I was based. So his family did have a lot of connections in the Far East, as it's known, but for us it's the Northwest, being here in Australia. So he had that fantastic, he was skinny at the time, he had a fantastic bone structure, a long face, a high brow, looming eyebrows. He had the perfect look for this kind of stuff, and Jack Pierce used him as the palette for his makeup. I was actually looking at the documentary of Jack Pierce that was attached to the Blu-ray of The Mummy that I was watching, and Jack Pierce used to, at the end of his career, was almost broke and unrecognized for the genius of his makeup work, and kind of just doing little bits and pieces on television now and then, which is a total shame. But in The Mummy in particular, apart from the iconic makeup in The Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein, in The Mummy, they layered, they kind of bleached linen and layered linen over his face. Pierce did a lot of stuff there with collodion and spirit gum and things like that. Took 6 hours to get Karloff into the mummy makeup, and by the time all that layered stuff was on his face, he couldn't move his facial muscles to speak in the full mummy makeup. Now, when we see him as Ardeth Bey, he's obviously had a drink of water and dried, you know, like hydrated a little bit, and he can speak, even though his skin does have a wrinkled, kind of slightly corpse-like texture. As the mummy itself in the full-on mummy makeup, which you can see is noticeably thicker than the Ardeth Bey makeup, wasn't able to talk. The plot line's fairly simple for the mummy, as indeed it is for the mummy's tomb. In 1921, an archaeological expedition led by Sir Joseph Wemple finds a mummy of an ancient Egyptian priest called Imhotep. When an inscription of the mummy by Wemple's friend Dr. Muller reveals that the guts were not removed, Muller deduces that although Imhotep had been wrapped like a traditional mummy, he was being buried alive. I'm reading this from Wikipedia. It's further revealed that Imhotep's horrific death was punishment for his sacrilege for attempting to resurrect his forbidden lover, Princess Ankh and his son, I've got to say this carefully, Princess Ankh Esenamun, which I mispronounced, sorry about that. Despite Muller's warning, Sir Joseph's assistant, Ralph Norton, played by Bramwell Fletcher, reads aloud an ancient life-giving scroll, the Scroll of Thoth. Imhotep rises and escapes with the scroll and prowls Cairo in search of the modern reincarnation of the princess. 10 years later, Imhotep is masquerading as a modern Egyptian named Ardeth Bey. He calls upon Sir Joseph's son, Frank, played by David Manners, and shows him where to dig to find the princess's tomb. After locating the tomb, the archaeologists present its treasures to the Makara Museum and thank Bey for making their discovery possible. Imhotep soon encounters a woman called Helen Grosvenor, played by Zita Johann, who bears a striking resemblance to the princess. Believing her to be the princess's reincarnation, he attempts to kill her with the intention of mummifying her, resurrecting her, and finally making her his bride. So that's basically the plot of the movie. It's not a long film. What we've got to remember is these old Universal horror films weren't the 2.5 hour epics we have now. 73 minutes, an hour and 13 minutes. Cost $196, made a fortune. And most of that off the director, Carl Freunde, was his first movie as a director. He was a cinematographer and quite a well-known one. He was a cinematographer on Metropolis, Dracula, and as it says on Wikipedia, for 6 years he was a cinematographer on I Love Lucy, in between 1951 and 1957. He did a lot of creative camera stuff, born of a Jewish family, and obviously left Europe to work in America when the drums of fascism were beating in the place. He actually worked on The Golem as well, The Last Laugh, which is the movie about Gwynplaine with Conrad Veidt in it. So he was all there during the Ufa years with all the German Impressionists, and he worked with Fritz Lang and things like that. Now, as a director, he was a bit of a shit. He was a short guy, really morbidly obese, and he didn't like his leading lady. Zita Johann and him didn't get on at all. He tried to use, he wasn't sure the movie was going to be successful. It was his first film, so he wanted to find a scapegoat. And so he decided that the leading lady would be his scapegoat and his easy get out of jail free card should the movie be a failure. So he and her didn't get on well at all. Nonetheless, the movie works well, and Zita Johann, who was a stage actress and very well regarded one in the 1920s on Broadway, is really good as Grosvenor. She's a little more forthright than women were in later days in Hollywood when the production code came on. She wears some very skimpy clothing and some low-cut cocktail dresses. And when she is dressed up by Imhotep / Ardeth Bey to look like the princess, she's wearing a very skimpy halter top. So there's a lot of her showing. There's no nipples or anything like that, but it's still very striking actress and very good too. There's a lot of nuance in her performance in this one. I really like it. The men less so. David Manners, Edward Van Sloan, we know, of course, he was in Dracula as well, but none of them are anywhere near as interesting as Karloff and Zita Johann. Now, Karloff's introduction in this movie is great. He's laying upright in the sarcophagus, and the scroll is red, and his eyes slowly open, and his hand moves down through the rotting bandages. And that slow eye opening, without any other facial movement, which may not have even been possible given the makeup the Karloff had on, was a creepy moment and a really effective one. I watched it now, and I've seen splatter films and torture porn, and I really admire the slow opening of Karloff's eyes in this film, and the kind of creepiness of us not seeing his character move apart from his eyes, his arm, one of his hands, which reaches out for the scroll, and then we see the bandages that are dangling off his feet slowly inching out of the tomb. Now, that's a nice introduction. It's very indirect. It doesn't show us the monster walking. In fact, with the amount of stuff wrapped around him, it may have been even difficult for Caliph to walk. But we see him 10 years later as an Egyptian guy working in the field of archaeology. And the bit that gets me, and the bit that we never see, what happened in those 10 years? There's a few things that would have had to happen. First off, the mummy would have had to get rid of the bandages and get some human clothing. He would have obviously had to hydrate because he looked dried out a lot as Imhotep the mummy. He would have had to learn English and at least one or two other languages, possibly Arabic as well. He would have had to create a persona for himself. He would have had to learn modern technology, all the way from radios to lights to automobiles and everything like that. So there's a 10-year arc in which the character of Imhotep had to travel 3,000 years through history and learn about modern society and modern ways and just modern belief systems as well. So that's a fascinating bit. The stuff that's not said in this movie is really interesting to me. But Caliph does it very well. And as Ardeth Bey, he's wearing a fez on his head and he's wearing robes and he walks with a cane. And, of course, he's got a very skinny frame, slightly hunched as well. And he is very evocative and very creepy as Ardeth Bey, particularly when he sees the Zita Johann character. He really does come across as a lustful ancient monster in a lot of ways, and every time I see Karloff again, and I rewatch it now a lot more closely than I've watched Karloff's films in the past, I see the little bits of stagecraft and the little bits of business that he does, and he's not only a very effective horror actor, he's a very fine actor. If you look at the range of roles he did in his career, for a lot of them, he played nasty characters, of course, because, obviously that was the cage that Hollywood and to an extent, stage roles put him in. He also did things like on stage, he was Captain Hook in Peter Pan in the 1950s, which is kind of cool. But, I love the craft of Karloff's acting. Leaving aside the wonderfulness of everything that's in Frankenstein, everything that's in this one, everything in Bride of Frankenstein, all the other movies he did, The Old Dark House, Mask of Frankenstein, the stuff he did with Val Lewton in the 1940s as well, and his work on television in the 1950s and early 1960s with things like Thriller. I just love the guy's acting, and I really should do more obscure Karloff films, including, say, Voodoo Island for future podcasts, because I admire his craft and his skill and his presence as an actor. He's not the guy you expect to be a star in Hollywood. You expect Tyrone Power and Clark Gable and people like that, but William Henry Pratt was a star at a certain time, as big as any of them. And I love the fact that he, in real life, apparently he was a very nice, gentle guy. Children liked him. He was well regarded by his family and friends. He was just kind of one of those guys who was happy to be where he was and doing what he was and being, even if it did mean that he was some typecast to a certain extent. He also did, as I said, a lot of stage work. He was actually in a whole bunch of different things on stage. He was in the original production of Arsenic and Old Lace in 1941. And when he played a homicidal gangster who was pissed off for being mistaken for Boris Karloff, he was in J.B. Priestley's play, The Linden Tree. He did The Lark opposite Julie Harris, a French play by Jean Anouilh, about Jeanne d'Arc, and all those kind of things. So he was enthusiastic about his craft. And he had a children's radio show in 1950 where he played children's music and told stories and riddles for children on radio. So you got to love the guy. I mean, he's just one of those people who really typifies what you'd like and what you'd expect from a movie star, but what way too often you don't actually get. So as Imhotep, that physical acting that he did so well is very much a part of it. And there are some bits where he's kind of telepathically causing someone to have a heart attack. And just watching the physical acting of Karloff while he's looking into a scrying pool, which has got dry ice clouds over it and things like that. The physical acting of him in those scenes is crazy effective. It's just a lovely thing to watch. Even I actually turned the sound off for a little bit because the music was annoying me slightly. It's very much 1930s style music. And just watching Karloff move and the way he reacted to other actors and the way he gave back. A lot of people just waiting for the next line in acting. But Karloff was actively listening a lot, the way good actors do. And just watching that kind of stuff was really interesting for me. And of course, this too was an original product by Universal Studios. It wasn't like Frankenstein based on a novel, or like Dracula based on a novel, or the Invisible Man, or the Phantom of the Opera, or any of those things. This and The Creature from the Black Lagoon are the two original creations of Universal Studios without having a pre-existing product to base the movie on. And I think that puts it in a place of its own. Of course, it was there was the Hammer Mummy from the 1950s, and there were any number of other mummy movies, including the one, there's a four movie arc that Universal themselves did in the 1940s. I'm going to be talking about the first one of those in a moment, where they basically retell, that's a remake almost, of this movie, but under the production code rather than being pre-code the way this one was. And it's weaker because of that. They actually use some of the footage from The Mummy in this 1941 film. And it's interesting to see what they leave in and what they cut out of that. But just to kind of finalize The Mummy, I like it. I like the production design. I like the titles as well. The titles are fantastic, where they had a rotating model of the Sphinx and the pyramids in Egypt with the mummy engraved on the back of one of the pyramids. And the model rotates so you can see the title of the movie come up. That's really nice. I like that. It's an effective little use of, giving us a time and a place for the story while you're putting the titles up. And given the fact that it can't be done with computer-generated effects, the physical effects of that little model were quite effective, and it was quite cool that they did that, where they could have just put up title cards. And I appreciate that little extra effort that they went to on it. But revisiting The Mummy was a lot of fun. Revisiting it on the big screen of my TV was a lot of fun too. And lots of little subtle bits you miss when you have a smaller TV screen that pop up at you with a larger one. So if you do have the wherewithal, and I appreciate that not everybody does, the bigger screen you can get for watching movies at home, the more you're going to see in the screen. But anyway, on that note of total greediness and avarice and smugness, I will leave the 1932 version of The Mummy, except to say, really watch it. If you haven't seen it, see it. If you've seen it before, it's very much worth revisiting, and you will notice things in it in rewatching it that you hadn't noticed the first once, twice, three times, however many times you've seen it. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to look at the 1940 reboot of the Mummy franchise, which basically retells the story of the first movie, and it's 1940's The Mummy's Hand, starring Dick Foran, Peggy Moran, Wallace Ford, and Cecil Kellaway and George Zucco.
Let me go! Let me go!
Do you mind if I say I think you're a swell person?
You're very beautiful. So beautiful, I'm going to make you immortal.
Hey, where's the girl?
Well, you'll never see her again.
I'll give you a treat to tell me where she is. I'm not kidding.
If you were to kill me, you're leaving at large a monster that only I can control.
So The Mummy's Hand is a 1940 Universal horror film. Used to reboot. Some people say it's a sequel or a follow-up to The Mummy, but basically it's a retelling of the story. So it's a reboot in the same way that the Tom Cruise movie is a reboot of the Brendan Fraser Mummy movies, in a sense. The movie starts out with And Hotep, played by George Zuko, and again I'm paraphrasing from Wikipedia, travelling to the Hill of the Seven Jackals, which looks a lot more like California than it does Egypt, to answer a summons from the High Priest of Karnak, played by Eduardo Cinelli. The dying priest of the sect explains the story of Karis, Tom Tyler, to his follower. The tale closely parallels that of the original film, except that Karis steals the sacred Tanna leaves in the hope of restoring life to Princess Ananka. His penalty upon being discovered is to be buried alive without a tongue, and the Tanna leaves are buried with him. So instead of a magical scroll, we've now got a potion made out of Tanna leaves to resurrect the mummy. So the leaves, during the cycle of the full moon, the fluid from the brew of three Tanna leaves is to be administered to keep Karis alive. Should the spoilers enter the tomb of the princess, a fluid of nine leaves will restore movement to the monster and he will protect the princess's tomb. So we've now got the modern day guys. We've got Steve Banning, played by Dick Foran, who did a lot of Western movies, and his psychic Babe Jensen, played by Wallace Ford, discover the remnants of a broken vase in a Cairo bazaar. Banning is convinced that it's an authentic Egyptian relic, and his interpretation of the hieroglyphics of the piece lead him to believe that it contains clues to the location of the princess's tomb. They convince an American magician, Salvani, played by Cecil Kellaway, who helps them fund the quest to find the tomb. His daughter Marta isn't so easily swayed, but they eventually convince her and they all go on the expedition and find the tombs. And eventually the mummy gets resurrected. They meet up with Zuko's character, Andoheb, which is hard to say at this time of a Sunday night. And he tries to protect the tombs. And you can see his side of the argument. I mean, despoiling ancient artifacts, even though they are giving them to the Cairo Museum, he's trying to protect this tomb. And you can kind of respect that at a certain level. The fact that he resurrects a dead guy who goes around killing people is probably where he crosses the line. But in general, you can see his point to a certain extent. Now, Dick Foran, as I said, was in a lot of Western movies, as indeed was Tom Tyler, who plays the mummy. And Tom Tyler's makeup isn't as good as Karloff's, to be really honest with you. And also, Tom Tyler isn't, even though he was tall, he was a cowboy actor, and he didn't have a large emotional range. I think he also played Captain Marvel in a movie serial in the 1940s as well, but I'll have to look that up to be sure. But we've also got some comic relief. Wallace Ford playing Babe is the comic relief for the piece, whereas Dick Foran's character Steve Banning is the romantic lead. And Wallace Ford's an interesting actor. Born in Lancashire, he was actually an orphan. His family was too poor to keep him, so he went to a Barnardo's home, and they sent him to Canada, where he grew up in Canada, and eventually drifted into acting in much in the same way that Boris Karloff did. You know, Karloff went to Canada, jobbed around, and then dropped into acting, and indeed Wallace Ford did that, and he had a long career into the 1960s in Westerns. He was a small, stocky guy. But he was good as a comic relief in this. A lot of comic relief in these kind of movies is annoying. But for some reason, Babe, his character, really doesn't have that annoying aspect to him. Peggy Moran's character, Marta, the niece of the magician, the stage magician, the great Salvati, played by Cecil Calloway, is good at what she does. She's not this kind of shrinking violet, screaming kind of girl, even though she does get carried by the mummy, as indeed you have to be in this kind of a movie. She's not a shrinking violet at all. And then you've got Cecil Calloway, an actor who was born in South Africa and spent most of his acting career, or his early part of his acting career, acting in Australia. He did Australian movies in the 1930s. And his magician, Salvani, who does little bits of sleight of hand and has a good time of it, both him and Wallace Ford play off each other nicely. And it kind of gives it a slightly lighter feel, this movie. Even though you've got the creepy stuff with the mummy, which is very much muted because of the production code. They couldn't do anything too scary, even in horror films in those days, because of the production code that was imposed in between 1932 and 1940. And you can definitely tell the difference in the movies before and after that, and we've talked about that before. But they do use some of the footage when they're doing the backstory to Carius. They use some of the footage from the original Mummy and kind of cut in inserts of Tom Tyler rather than Karloff. You can tell it's Karloff in a lot of scenes because Karloff's arms are a lot skinnier and sinewier than Tom Tyler's are. And there's some scenes where the people who are burying the princess's tomb have spears thrown at them by the guards so that nobody knows where the tomb is. And in the original version, you see one guy speared right all the way through with a spear sticking out of his chest and his back. They cut that out of the bit that you see in the mummy's hand because obviously you can't do that in a production code movie. So that just shows the little bits and pieces of stuff. And of course, Peggy Moran's character doesn't get into skimpy outfits in the way that Zita Johann's character did in the mummy. So there's all that kind of neutering and kind of watering down of the stuff that people go to see movies for, pretty women in skimpy costumes and horror. I was playing with my camera then, and it just made a beep. But in spite of that, the movie's only 66 minutes long, so it wasn't really long at all. It had half the budget of the first movie. But nonetheless, there were three movies after this with the mummy in it. And that surprised me. I actually picked these up cheaply on Blu-ray. They were double set Blu-rays of The Mummy's Hand with The Mummy's Tomb and then The Mummy's Ghost and The Mummy's Curse on the other disc. So they're pretty good too. The transfers are good. They're very clean transfers. But this movie, directed by a guy called Christy Carbani, isn't anywhere near as good, of course, as the Karloff Mummy. But it's amusing and entertaining. People, you know, having Cecil Calloway in there and Wallace Ford, it kind of keeps it going where it is. And Dick Foran's pretty good. They used some sets that were left over from a movie that John Huston wrote the script for called Green Hell. That was a big temple set for the climax. And because of that, because they reused that set, it kind of has a production value higher than the budget might have indicated. And there's climax of the film, the bit where Carice is confronted by Steve Banning and his mate Babe after the mummy captures Marta. It really is effective. It's a dead simple action scene. We see the mummy throwing a couple of guys around. Marta tells them that they've got to keep him away from the Tanner Leaf potion. They find ways of doing that. And they find a way of dispatching Carice using stuff that's around the temple. And so it's a really well blocked out action scene. And it is very effective. Now, the interesting thing about this, and this kind of moves on into the next film in the series, The Mummy's Tomb, which is set in Massachusetts and happens 30 years after The Mummy's Hand. And you still have the same, you have a couple of the same characters in it. You have Steve Banning and Babe as well, both 30 years older, who Carice apparently isn't destroyed at the end of the mummy's hand and comes back again, and with the help of Turhan Bey playing the George Zuko role, and George Zuko playing the role, playing a similar role to the role played by Edward Cianelli. In this movie, the mummy is transported to Massachusetts and kills Dick Foran and Wallace Ford's character so that the other actors can move on with it. It's a really weird little sequel to The Mummy's Hand because, A, you don't see many mummy movies set in Massachusetts. B, you don't see many mummy movies where 30 years later, but actually 2 years in real time, the actors from the previous film were knocked off by the mummy. It's just a weird thing, this kind of the way this franchise went in the 1940s and the way that it was kind of watered down and diminished, but still kind of amusing. I mean, this movie is not unamusing, and it's mostly because of the character actor bits. And I can't credit highly enough how many times character actors have saved a movie. George Zuko as Andoheb is very good too. He's got a creepiness and a gravitas about him that makes his character work. In fact, in some ways, his acting is the strongest in the film. And his Andoheb is a really real menacing character and very effective at what he does. But you still get back to Cecil Kellaway doing little bits of sleight of hand and having a bit of fun there. And Wallace Ford as a comedy sidekick who shows some chops as an actor as well. He's a kind of buffoonish character, but he's not without his resources. I like doing these two movies back-to-back for a couple of simple reasons, one of which is one's a remake of the other done only 8 years later by the same studio, something which we've seen again with the Spider-Man franchise reinventing itself every 8 years or so. So that actually happened back in the 1930s, 1940s. Plus, you've got this change that was caused by the introduction of the production code, where the movies weren't as horrifying and as creepy as the ones before the production code. And the material and the portrayal of violence wasn't as crafted, because every time they wanted to do something interesting or every time they wanted to do something shocking, the censors would come in and kind of knock that out. So they had to bring in things like the comic relief stuff from Cecil Kellaway and Wallace Ford, which takes the movie in a different direction. It takes it out of being a horror movie and takes it into a lighter and less scary form of entertainment, which ultimately, of course, led to the Abbott and Costello versus Frankenstein kind of thing, where because you couldn't show a full-on proper horror film as a part of the Universal Studios production schedule, they went with silly light stuff. And that's an unfortunate side effect of that production code. It really did diminish and knock the ass out of the filmmakers, all of whom could have made much better and much more nuanced and much more scary and complex and wonderful movies than they did, were it not for the fact that one of their hands was tied behind their backs and they were half blindfolded by the production code. But it's worth checking out these films. Of course, it's worth checking out The Mummy, but checking out The Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy's, I've got to get them right because I keep forgetting them. The Mummy's Hand, The Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy's Ghost, and The Mummy's Curse. The Mummy's Curse sounds a bit like menstruation, doesn't it? Nonetheless, Tom Tyler's not very good as Carice. And the weird thing is, when you see Lon Chaney Jr. playing the mummy in the other films in the franchise, the funny thing is he's unrecognizable. You could have got an extra to play the role that Lon Chaney Jr. played in these mummy movies. The makeup's basically a mask, and he doesn't get to talk because he had his tongue cut out. And so I don't even know why they bothered getting Lon Chaney Jr. and not just some guy off the street to play the role, because there wasn't much there to chew on. Nonetheless, as I said, the movie's diminished over the arc of this four-movie series. Nonetheless, it's fun to watch. It's fun to go back and revisit movie history. And either one of these two films is, in its way, 30 or 40 times more entertaining than the recent Tom Cruise mummy movie, which turned it from a horror film into a Tom Cruise vehicle. Okay, so I'm going to leave it there. It's not going to be a particularly long podcast this time. As I said, I'm still finding my feet after all this retirement stuff. But nonetheless, I will be back next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast, in 2 weeks with a Martian Drive-In podcast. Much better researched and much more timely. And hopefully with some more cool horror films or science fiction films or fantasy films. Maybe I should do some more fantasy films. That'd be called for, I think. But anyway, look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Take care wherever you are. If you're stressed out, hopefully this podcast may have helped you with that stress. And I've been told by a couple of people that occasionally it has seen them through some wobbly bits. And if you're going through that, please take care of yourselves and get every resource you can to look after yourselves. So I'm going to go now. And of course, I am going to leave you with a song and, of course, the credits to thank the wonderful and generous, shallow-pocketed Patreon supporters who donate as little as a dollar a month to help the podcast out. So take care of yourselves, and I'll be back very soon.
I'm a mummy. I scare people. Watch what happens when I walk up to somebody. I'm a mummy. I was born 1,959 years ago. My daddy was a mummy too. Watch what happens when I walk up to somebody. I'm a mummy. I don't try to scare people. I really came back to life to buy a copy of Cookie Cookie, Lend Me Your Comb. But people run from me. Watch what happens when I walk up to somebody. I'm a mummy. I wish there was somebody somewhere who wasn't afraid of me. Oh well. Watch what happens when I walk up to somebody. I'm a mummy.
That's cool.
I'm a mummy.
You mean you're a mother?
No, I'm a mummy.
I'm a beatnik.
People are afraid of me.
Yeah, I'm hip.
I was born 1,959 years ago.
Oh yeah? Like, that's a long gig.
Where can I buy a copy of Cookie Cookie, Lend Me Your Comb?
Ooh, man, I don't dig that jazz. You know, Brubeck, Shearing, modern jazz quartet.
I'm a mummy.
Man, you gotta walk through.
Aren't you afraid of me? Aren't you gonna scream?
Oh yeah. Like help.
Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Carrie, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.